Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night on PBS, an amazing documentary is going to be airing that shines a light on a chapter of our history that I dare say many of us do not know anything about. The film is called The Lavender Scare, and it is based on an important book of the same title by David K. Johnson. And in this documentary, we learn about a chapter in our history that officially began in 1953 with an executive order from President Dwight D. Eisenhower, which essentially ordered the firing of all homosexuals working for the federal government. And this is actually an executive order that remained in effect for decades. And it led to the dismissal of 10,000 people from their jobs, people who were qualified to serve our country and to serve our government, and who were dismissed in this way. And the Lavender Scare refers to the way in which this was related to the Red Scare going on at the very same time, and sprang out of that same rampaging fear of communism somehow entering our American life. Josh Howard is both producer and director of this remarkable film, which draws us back to that time and into the lives of just some of the men and women who whose lives were so adversely affected by this. And it is not only a very sad and troubling story, but also an inspiring one as well, because it is really out of this that the birth of the gay rights movement, as we think of it, actually began. So we meet some people who were really part and parcel of some of the first efforts to secure for the gays of America their civil rights. And I'm excited to have Josh Howard with me on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about his film, again titled The Lavender Scare. Josh Howard, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So how did you first become acquainted with this story of The Lavender Scare?
Well, it was something I knew nothing about. I happened to come across a book called The Lavender Scare, written by David K. Johnson, who's a historian, teaches at the University of South Florida. And I was just amazed as I was reading this book. I thought I knew American history, some gay history, but I had no idea the extent to which the government had this this procedure to try to identify and fire every gay man and lesbian working for the government. And I was just stunned as I was reading this.
Tell us about the genesis of this film project, and also say a word about how challenging it was to be able to tell this story as richly as you do.
Well, it was quite challenging because a number of the people who were first-person sources for David Johnson and his book, by the time I got involved in this, they had sadly passed away. David did most of his research during the 1990s. I first read the book in 2009 and met with David. Actually, the first time we met to discuss this project was on July 4th, 2009. So it is coming up on 10 years since we first talked about turning this into a film. So that itself speaks to how difficult it was to get this wrapped up. But it wasn't just a matter of finding the right characters and, you know, finding people who were still available. But we had to raise money for the film. That was a long, complicated process. But really the genesis of the project was, as I said, I read the book. I was happily retired, I thought, from a long career in television news. But when I came across this book, it just seemed like such a natural for a documentary, and not just, you know, something that would make a good film, but something that really needed to be documented. This story is just not known by people, and you know, I was aware that if we didn't, you know, the time to do it was then, because the window in terms of getting people to, you know, be interviewed was quickly closing.
Right. I want to add just parenthetically that right after I watched your amazing film, I called up my younger brother, Steve, who happens to be gay. I've mentioned him before over the air in various contexts. And I asked him if he happened to know the name of Dr. Franklin Kameny, who is one of the principal figures in your film. And my brother, who is very well-read, had no idea who this man was or the importance that he had in the earliest days of what we think of now as the gay rights movement. And so there are all kinds of people, including people we might blithely assume already know this story, that in fact do not. So I'm so grateful that your film has been made.
Well, you know, Frank is really an unsung hero of the movement. It's hard to come up with another name of someone who contributed as much over the years to the gay rights movement as he did, and he is not well known even within the gay community. And you know, it's really partly a function of the fact that gay history isn't taught in schools. Only recently has there been some attention paid to it. And you know, Frank is the Rosa Parks of the gay rights movement. Here was an individual, a private person, who had no intention of starting a movement and was you know, thrust into this. And it was one of the reasons I really wanted to make this film, to you know, pay tribute to him. And you know, as a very small band of activists in the early 1960s, in the years, you know, way before Stonewall, who really did get the ball rolling on the gay rights movement.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Josh Howard, producer and director of a remarkable documentary film that airs tomorrow night on PBS called The Lavender Scare, based on a book of the same name by David K. Johnson. It talks about what occurred to thousands and thousands of gay men and women in the 1950s and thereafter, thanks to an executive order from President Eisenhower, which called for the dismissal of all homosexuals working for the government, a systematic campaign that devastated many, many lives. I appreciated, Mr. Howard, the fact that your film includes some historical context that takes us back to World War II, and to the fact that for many young gay men and women, World War II turned out to be an experience of awakening for many of them. Explain what I'm talking about.
Well, that was another thing I just found fascinating about the story as I was reading David's book. I guess I had always assumed that homophobia was something that was built into the fabric of our history. And what David's book points out is that beginning even before World War II, in the years of the Depression, at a time when the government was adding a huge number of new jobs, Washington was becoming this boom town. The federal payroll was increasing dramatically, and a lot of the people who moved to Washington, D.C. to take these new jobs, disproportionately, they were gay. And a couple of reasons for that. Gay single people, it was easier for them to pull up stakes from wherever they were living and move to Washington. But also a good number of them wanted to leave their small towns and move to a place where they would find greater acceptance. And in fact, Washington had quite a vibrant gay community in those years. Then World War II comes along, and the mass mobilization of the population again had the effect of pulling millions of young men and women out of their small towns, out of their homes, and put them in, you know, these same-sex situations in which, for the first time, a lot of gay men and lesbians had the opportunity to find other people like themselves. And, you know, that created, quite a growing community of gay people.
One of the things I appreciated in your film was a moment when we see photographs from the period, quite a few, more than a dozen, I would say, which would appear to show young gay men in the Navy or young gay women in the Navy posing together, arms around each other, and we just it's not the kind of thing that we think of when we think of that era in America.
Well, it's true, and you know, the military, particularly at the height of the war, was looking the other way when there were instances of gay relationships within the ranks, because frankly, you know, we needed people to fight, and they didn't have the luxury of necessarily doing mass removal of gay men and lesbians. It wasn't really until after the war that the military really cracked down on homosexuality within the ranks. As one character in the film says, who came from a very small town, he said, "I had no idea how many people were gay until I joined the Navy."
Right.
And, you know, the line gets a laugh at theaters frequently, but it really is, speaks to what was happening at the time.
Right. And I must say, too, that from this part of the film, a very moving moment is when we hear from the journal of someone by the name of Lad Forrester. And he would be someone who welcomed the opportunity to come to Washington, D.C., and take a job there. And there in Washington, D.C., he found a community of gays that he had no idea existed. And from this journal entry, he attends his first party with men dancing together and so on. And you quote his journal as him saying, "I could not hold back tears." I mean, how profoundly moving it was for him to see a sight like that and realize that he had a community and something he had never experienced in his life before, we presume.
Exactly. I mean, he's an example of someone who grew up, as he said in his journal, in a small Mississippi River town. And, I'm certain he had never met another gay person. And suddenly he is there in Washington meeting people like himself and being able to make a personal connection for the first time. And it, that's a story that was repeated time after time.
World War II ends and America finds itself in a very, very prosperous, optimistic period. But very quickly, there is this terrible fear which becomes paranoia regarding the threat of communism, the threat of spies. Explain how this Red Scare is transformed into this Lavender Scare. What was the mechanism by which that occurred?
Well, the concern was that the initial concern was that communists were infiltrating the federal government. You know, Russia had been our ally during World War II, but in the years after the war, this our relationship obviously with them deteriorated, and so there was concern about spies and communists infiltrating the government. The theory then became that gay people, and there were many more homosexuals working in the government than there had been communists at the time. But the thought was that if you're gay, you could be susceptible to blackmail by an enemy agent, and you might divulge government secrets in exchange for being able to keep your sexuality secret. And so there was suddenly this campaign to try to identify and then remove all gay people who were working for the government.
One of the most chilling aspects of your film is when you share with us what amount to brief excerpts from some of the files compiled about some of these men and women who ultimately were dismissed from their positions. And there is something very, very cold about the language and also intensely offensive language sometimes used that behind the guise of sort of an official process, which was really not due process at all. Explain kind of the mechanism by which these dismissals would occur.
Well, each individual agency had its own investigative team that was looking into the personal lives of its employees. And, you know, leads would come from a bunch of different places. At times, agents would stake out when they left the bar and then question them. They would take down license plate numbers of cars parked in the vicinity of gay bars. But what was the most effective tool was if an agent had someone before them who they were interviewing who they believed was gay, they would say, give us the names of five other people. You know, we'll go easy on you, but just give us the names of five other people who are gay, and, you know, conceivably we'll let you go and go about your business. And it was through that procedure that the government built this, you know, huge, you know, they were able to identify a huge number of people. And, you know, interestingly enough, it was the close relationships that developed during the Depression and the war years among the gay community that really worked against the interests of the community, because everybody did know everybody else or know some other people who were gay. And, you know, the years of the Lavender Scare really were terrifying for gay people in Washington, because, you know, no one knew when someone would, identify them to save themselves.
Right. Yeah, it's probably important for us to remember just what a frightening time that was for just about anybody, not only if you were, in a sense, a likely target, but also, if you even knew someone who might be a likely target and might be seen as guilty by association in some way. It's just terrible to think about what it was like to live within that kind of environment. And
well,
of course,
one of the investigators who we spoke to said that if they identified a heterosexual who, as he put it, who knew and identified with homosexuals, they would investigate the heterosexual person. So it was really, the message was, you know, was sent by the federal government, stay away from gay people because you'll be in trouble if you're found to be associating with a gay person.
I have to mention that one of the people that you interview in the film is a John W. Haynes, who was an official with the State Department. He was one of the participants in this process of whatever you want to call it, eradication of gays from the ranks of federal employees. And in this interview, which I don't believe you are conducting, someone else is conducting, but he is, in a sense, given the opportunity to express regret over what he did all those decades earlier. And he really expresses no regret whatsoever, which is a truly chilling moment in the film.
Well, he was not only a participant, he was number three in the State Department at the time. So it was, and director of security. So it was his office and his decision specifically to administer this program. And we were very lucky to be able to track him down and ask him if he wanted to be interviewed. And, you know, like the other government investigators who we approached, we were kind of expecting him to say, you know, no, why would I want to be part of this? Why would I want to talk about this now? And to our surprise, he said, of course, come on up. And it was only when we did the interview that it finally dawned on us that, well, the reason, you know, there's these the government officials were still so happy to talk to us was every single one of them defended what they did in the 1950s and 60s and beyond. And, still to this day, don't see anything wrong with it. they all said, look, we wouldn't do the same thing today because society has changed, and so we wouldn't have the same policy in effect now. But what we did in the 1950s, that was the right thing to do. And it was, the interview was conducted by Jill Landis, my associate director. And as you say, it was chilling. We gave Mr. Haynes several opportunities to say this was wrong, and that's not his opinion.
Right.
We're very grateful to be able to, have him express that and include that in the film.
It's an important part of the story. And, of course, it's important to say, and your film says it more than once, that there is not one single bit of evidence that any gay person working for the federal government was ever threatened with blackmail. I mean, this thing that they were so fearful of, and a fear out of which they fired 10,000 plus men and women, it sprang from a fear of a threat that was in fact non-existent or had never ever occurred before. I mean, that's what makes this really maddening.
Well, when the policy was put into effect, there hadn't been a single case. And a study later that was done later in the 1970s, looking back on that time period, as well, could not find a single case of a gay man or lesbian submitting to blackmail in the face of pressure from an enemy agent. The thing to point out though is that in fact these people were susceptible to blackmail, and it was our own government that was blackmailing them. Because very frequently, government investigators would say to them, cooperate with us, turn in your friends, or we're going to expose you to your, to your family, to your neighbors. And so the exact tool that they were afraid enemy agents were going to use against gay men and lesbians, government investigators themselves were using.
Hmm. We meet some of the people whose lives were so sadly affected by this, but we want to spend the last couple minutes of this interview talking about the inspiring figure who is really the first person to stand his ground and say, no, I will not accept this injustice, Dr. Franklin E. Kameny. And we hear from him directly, and we also hear excerpts from a number of letters that he wrote as these events were engulfing his life. Explain to our listeners why he is such an important person that all of us need to know.
Well, Frank was an astronomer. He had a degree from astronomy from Harvard University, and he was a brilliant scientist, but he was also single-minded and determined. And as he used to say, if the world and he differed on a matter, then after giving it careful second thought, if that was still the case, he was right and the world was wrong. Probably 5,000 people, we estimate, had been fired by the government before Frank Kameny got pulled into this. And he got pulled into it because he was sitting at his desk one day, and two investigators came up to him and said, "We have evidence that you're a homosexual. What, what do you have to say in your defense?" And he had no defense because he was gay, and he was fired from his job. But unlike the 5,000 or so people who had been fired before him, who all went quietly, Frank said, I'm not going to go quietly. I'm not going to give you my resignation. I'm going to fight this because I think this policy is wrong, and I think I deserve to have my job." And he fought his firing through administrative channels, through the courts. At some point, when no lawyers would represent him any longer, he wrote his own petition to the U.S. Supreme Court. He lost it every step of the way and never got his job back. But in the process, he wound up being a gay activist who really devoted every minute of the rest of his life to the fight for gay rights.
You have, among other things, transcriptions of the first time he testified before Congress as the first openly gay person to testify before Congress, and it is disturbing to hear the undisguised disrespect of at least some of the congressmen who are listening to him, and the forthright way in which he stands up to them is truly inspiring. And he also organized some of the first public picketing in front of the White House by a small group of gay men and women. I mean, it was, these efforts began, in a sense, modestly, but courageously. And it's important for us to understand how it led to a whole movement and something that he probably never even envisioned might occur.
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, we're observing the 50th anniversary this month of the Stonewall Rebellion, which is frequently thought of as the start of the gay rights movement. And, you know, as important as that event was in the history of the movement, it's really important, I think, to recognize that there were a small group of courageous people who, years earlier than that, really began this process and really, you know, set in motion what would become the modern gay rights movement. And, you know, it's really interesting to think, you know, what would have started the movement, and where would society have been in the years that followed. Mm.
The film, again, is The Lavender Scare. It airs tomorrow night on PBS. The producer and director, Josh Howard. Josh Howard, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you so much for creating this powerful and important film.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It's 8:37, and you are listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two is coming up in just a moment. As we look back 100 years to the Titanic disaster, we, of course, do so on the one hand with a sweeping sense of the totality of that tragedy. But in some respects, what's really most important is if we think of those many people who went to their death as individuals. And it is as we hold up the individual story of, first of all, courageous survivors, but also of those who courageously perished. In a sense, that is when this disaster, in all of its emotional magnitude, comes to fullness. And certainly that was my experience in exploring the book A Titanic Love Story, Ida and Isidore Strauss. They were a couple aboard the Titanic who went down to their death when Ida Strauss refused to climb aboard one of the lifeboats with other women and children, choosing to stay on deck with her husband, Isidore, who happened to be one of the co-owners of Macy's department store. So one of the most wealthy and influential and admired men in America, it is safe to say. And incredibly, no book has yet been written or published focusing on Isidore and Ida Strauss until now. And June Hall McCash has done a beautiful job in telling this story, and not only of that fateful night on the Titanic, but also the very rich and fascinating story of the Strausses, of their backgrounds, of how they met, the building of this extraordinary legacy called Macy's, and of course about the devotion they had to one another, which in a sense made their final hours and that decision by Ida not a surprise at all, but just the last in a whole series of devoted acts of loyalty and love to one another. The book again is called A Titanic Love Story, Ida and Isidore Strauss. It's published by Mercer University Press. And June Hall McCash, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
In the preface to the book, you say that it's hard to reconstruct just exactly when you first became so enamored with this particular story. But you do make mention of the fact that when one watches James Cameron's famous movie, now out in 3D re-release, there is a scene that a lot of people suppose to be a brief, wordless view of the Strausses just before death. In fact, it almost certainly is not meant to depict them, and that, in fact, a scene that had been shot depicting them fell on the cutting room floor and is not part of the film. Beyond all that, which I think a lot of people maybe do know, I think you make a really telling observation about the fact that by leaving the Strausses out of the film altogether, James Cameron is making a very unfortunate choice because, in fact, as a couple, they embodied so much about what this film is about.
Exactly. In fact, I think some of the words that Ida said to Isidore that night were actually borrowed and put in the mouth of Rose in the film. I think the couple in bed, the elderly couple in bed, are a kind of allusion to the Strausses. But since they were the only first-class couple who died together on the Titanic, it certainly was not at all the way it happened. In fact, it's a very beautiful story, exactly what happened. Ida actually did, as you said, get into a lifeboat, and then realizing Isidore was not going to be able to follow her, she got out again, took off her fur coat, gave it to her maid, and said, "I won't need this anymore," and gave her maid the seat in the lifeboat. And she turned to Isidore and said, "I'd rather die with you than live without you."
One of the things you mentioned in the preface as you touch on this is the fact that there is remarkable similarity amongst the many accounts that were given of exactly how this happened, of exactly what was said. And of course, the more one reads the stories and accounts of survivors from the Titanic, the more you realize how, first of all, maybe imaginative people get, how capricious people's memories can be. And so the fact that this story was told with such remarkable unanimity amongst the many people who witnessed it, who survived to tell of it, in a sense, that's, first of all, reassuring that we can, in a sense, know as much as we do, but also that it obviously was a very powerful gesture that sort of seared itself on the minds of those who witnessed it.
Exactly. And there were quite a few eyewitnesses, some of whom were actually in the lifeboats. They tried to get Ida into two different lifeboats. And at one point, she simply grasped the rail and refused to even be dragged into one, which some of them were trying to do. But everyone who told the story told essentially the same story. The words might differ just a bit, but the crux of the story is identical from every single passenger. And they were told from the point of view of some of the women in the lifeboat and some of the men survivors who didn't get in the lifeboats but were later rescued. So it's quite an amazingly consistent story and one of the few that is completely consistent.
Hmm. Since we're already talking about, in a sense, the end of the story, I want to proceed further and say that one thing I appreciated about your book was that it begins with the news reaching America of the Titanic disaster. And I think you do a beautiful job of, in a sense, putting us in the shoes of the family members back in America. And, of course, they were just one of thousands who waited anxiously for some kind of news of who had survived. And in this case, had their beloved parents, Ida and Isidore, survived this catastrophe. And I think you do an exceptionally fine job of helping us appreciate just how terrible those days of waiting had to be for the Strauss family.
and how tense they were. In fact, they didn't know for 4 days for certain whether their parents had lived or died, and they were frantic to get news, used every means possible. They kept grasping every hope that came in. And oftentimes the news reports were completely inaccurate. In one case, they actually said all Titanic survivors have been saved. They are all aboard, and they gave the name of the ship, exactly when it would arrive in Halifax and that sort of thing. Of course, it turned out to be utterly false. But at that point, one of Isidore's sons had already booked a train to Nova Scotia, to Halifax, Nova Scotia, to meet his parents, and then only to discover that, in fact, they had both died.
Mm. We're speaking with June Hall McCash, and we're talking about her book, which is called A Titanic Love Story, Ida and Isidore Strauss. And, of course, we've spent pretty much all of our time thus far talking about what happened to the Strausses aboard the Titanic, when, in fact, your book is, of course, about much more than that. You have chosen to tell the story of both of these people and the very interesting lives they led, and, of course, which the stirring success which they enjoyed. Isidore as one of the owners of Macy's department store, and Ida, his very capable and significant partner, not only in love and life, but a very creative and interesting woman of her own accord. I wonder if you could just say a word about just how quickly the Strauss family rose in prominence. I was not prepared for just how humble their beginnings were when they first immigrated to this country in the 1850s.
Right. Isidore Strauss's father, Lazarus Strauss, came to this country 2 years before his family. He came in 1850 and became a peddler. He drove a wagon around the state of Georgia and sold wares off his wagon. And then within one generation, they owned Macy's department store. It's a remarkable American story, I think, in many respects. Isidore was a very entrepreneurial young man. He didn't have a great deal of, he had no higher education. And what he learned at firsthand, in a sense. He learned by experience. Unlike his brothers, and especially his younger brother, whom he managed to make certain got all the education he could get. He went to Columbia University and Columbia School of Law, became a diplomat and a cabinet member in Teddy Roosevelt's cabinet. But Isidore himself was a very smart man, and he spent the Civil War years in England kind of in an entrepreneurial way, buying and selling bonds, Confederate bonds, which of course ultimately became worthless. But he was very successful in that and was able to come home after his parents, who lived in Columbus, Georgia, lost virtually everything in the Battle of Columbus, the last battle of the Civil War, in fact, that was fought after the signing of the peace treaty at Appomattox. But he came back, and he had with him $10,000 in gold, and that was the way they started over again in New York.
Your story includes, of course, the sad traces of anti-Semitism, which, for instance, the Strausses experienced in Georgia. It's part of what prompted them to move to Columbus. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is an important thing to acknowledge. It was a reality that was always at least in the background of their lives.
Unfortunately, that's true. When Isidore's father first came to Georgia, he detected no signs of anti-Semitism at all. But the Civil War brought out frequently the worst in people. And when they wanted to blame someone for whatever problems there were, in this case, profiteering during the war, they chose to blame the Jews. In fact, Gentiles as well as Jews were profiteering, and Isidore's father was an extremely honest man. In fact, after the war, he paid off every single debt, even though his New York, his northern, the ones he owed money to, said, you know, we've written this off already. You don't really have to pay it. He said, no, if I leave nothing else to my sons, I will leave them a good name. And he paid every penny he owed. But anti-Semitism, unfortunately, that little incident in Talbotton, Georgia, caused them to move to Columbus. And you would think, well, perhaps once they were wealthy and well-known in New York, that would not happen. In fact, it happened even then. Isidore wrote a letter to the headmaster of St. Bernard's Academy in New York, encouraging or supporting the application of his grandson. And the headmaster was compelled to write back and say, if we admit, as what he called a Hebrew child, all of our Gentile children would leave the academy. So even once they were successful and wealthy in New York, that sense of anti-Semitism still prevailed. It wasn't a dominant factor in their lives by any means, and Isidore and Ida associated with everyone, regardless of race, regardless of religion, and any of that. The only criterion was that they needed to be interesting people to be invited to their home. but one would like to think one would be invited, but in any case, they certainly experienced from time to time this blight of anti-Semitism.
Right. Your book, of course, is not meant to be an exhaustive history of Macy's, although I think you do a wonderful job of explaining how this company emerged and how it sort of stepped into the limelight in kind of a new era of greatness. It's an impressive story, and of course one can go elsewhere for even more details, but I think you tell enough of the story for us to get a sense of what a glittering sort of success this was for them. But you also spend a great deal of time talking about the Strausses as philanthropists and the fact that they cared about their fellow man and worked tirelessly to make the world a better place. I mean, in many respects, this is as inspiring as anything in their story.
It certainly is. And when Isidore and Ida died, the Educational Alliance, of which Isidore had been president and was an organization that helped immigrant families try to get settled in New York, when the death of those two people came, they held a memorial service or planned to hold a memorial service, and their hall of their building that Isidore had helped raise money for would only hold 700 people, and the crowd was estimated at between 20 and 40,000 people who showed up. They were fearful. They had to call in extra police support and finally never opened the doors because they were afraid people would be crushed to death. Some weeks later, they held another service at Carnegie Hall, and it poured down rain the day of that service. Even so, 7,000 people gathered and stood outside in the rain to be part of that.
I wonder if you could say a word about Ida and the fact that she was such a vibrant part of this partnership and a valuable helpmate and advisor to her husband and such a creative, vibrant person in her own right. And is this something that was she exceptionally so in her era?
Well, that's an interesting question. Like many women of that era, she was there as the helpmeet and support of her husband primarily, and her children. Her goal was to raise good, honest, and noble children, and she certainly succeeded in that. But she was a woman with many talents as well. She was an artist, and there's a few of her drawings and things have survived, and they're quite accomplished. She actually was a poet as well, and one of her poems was published in the New York Times, both before and after her death. Again, she did not like, as Isidore didn't, any kind of accolade. They were very modest people, very humble people, and she didn't allow them to publish her name with the poem the first time it was published, but after her death, they republished it with her name to underscore the character of her her life and her selfhood. She was Isidore and Ida wrote to each other every day they were separated. In fact, it on occasions. Isidore was a congressman from 1894 to 1896, and he wrote Ida not only every day, but sometimes more than once a day, sometimes as many as three times a day, to make her a part of everything he did. And yes, he valued her her advice, and he was certainly free to give her advice as well. But it was just such a loving relationship that it's quite remarkable. And I think that kind of thing is perhaps unusual in any time. As far as her creativity, of course, Ida would have been unusual even today, I think.
One, of course, unhappy irony is that the two of them should not, in fact, have really been aboard the Titanic, that it was only a fairly last-minute change of plans that put them aboard the Titanic. Explain briefly to our listeners what their initial plans had been, plans which, if followed, would have carried them back to America from the south of France on a completely different ship.
Well, they had spent the winter in the south of France, and as they frequently did, had a wonderful, wonderful final trip together. And they had booked passage on the sister ship of the Titanic called the Olympic. Unfortunately, the Olympic sailing was delayed by a few weeks. There was a coal strike going on in England, and it was very difficult for the White Star Line to have both ships sailing as early as they did. So they held back the Olympic for the Titanic special sailing. It was supposed to sail on April the 10th. And Isidore was a bit eager to get back to New York. He had had some concerns about something that was going on at the store. And his sons kept saying, well, there's no reason to hurry back. We basically got it under control. But he was, of course, very interested and very concerned. So he booked early. Isidore had also all his life been interested in the latest and most modern ships. And so I think he was not dissatisfied to be sailing on the Titanic. It was supposed to be the greatest ship in the world, and virtually, as the White Star Line insisted, virtually unsinkable. So their unfortunate change of plans came within the final weeks of their stay in France, and you know the result of that.
Absolutely. These words are in your beautifully written preface. Few of us ever have the need or opportunity to test the absolute limits of love, as Ida Strauss did when she chose not to get into a lifeboat, but to remain on the deck of the sinking ship rather than leave her husband to die alone. That is just one facet of the truly beautiful, resplendent love story of Ida and Isidore Strauss, told in this book called A Titanic Love Story, published by Mercer University Press. June Hall-McCash, congratulations on crafting a truly remarkable book, an exceptionally interesting and moving book that I hope people will seek out in this 100th anniversary year of the Titanic.
Thank you so very much. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll be hearing my interview with Mark Siegel, the author of a fascinating memoir called And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality. Mark Siegel was on hand for the Stonewall Uprising and for many of the major events of the early days of the gay rights movement. On Wednesday, I look forward to speaking with Holly Stanfield and two very talented young men who were part of the cast of the production of The Scottsboro Boys, based on a very troubling story out of American history when a small group of black boys and teenagers were unjustly accused of rape and what befell them. It's a remarkable musical which will soon be taken to a major event. Later on, we'll be looking at the